Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, email, Google+, simple ways that you can share Issues Etc. programs with your friends, relatives, and fellow parishioners. Just go to Listen on Demand Archives at issuesetc.org and look for the share feature images posted beneath each audio segment. You're only one click away from telling someone about Issues Etc. The Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org and look for Share This.
It is often asserted and sometimes accepted without any examination, uncritically, that the fossil record, you know, the strata of rock and sediments that contain all those fossils, that the fossil record has been evolution's best friend. It's the book wherein evolution purports to read its evidence for an extremely old age of the Earth and a very gradual and completely random and by chance evolution of life. Is the fossil record the evolutionist's best friend? And is there a part, a significant part, of that fossil record that actually is a huge problem for Darwin, Darwinism, neo-Darwinism, and the evolutionary theory? And how can it be best explained, the so-called Cambrian explosion? Joining us to talk about Charles Darwin and the Cambrian explosion, Dr. Stephen Meyer. He's director of the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute based in Seattle. He's author of numerous books, including his latest, Darwin's Doubt, The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design. Dr. Meyer, welcome to Issues Etc.
Good to be with you.
Most of the time, the fossil record is presented as just hands-down evidence for Darwin's theory of evolution. Is there a major part of that fossil record itself that neither Darwin nor the supporters of his theory today can satisfactorily explain?
Well, there is. Also, I think the fossil record has overall never been really friendly to the Darwinian picture of the history of life, because overall it presents a discontinuous picture of the origin of major groups of animals. But within that overall picture, there's one particular event in the history of life that troubled Darwin, and which has become more and more troubling over the years for modern neo-Darwinists, and it's the fossil documentation of the first major groups of animals in the history of life. It's known today as the Cambrian explosion. And this is an event in which the major groups of animals first appear abruptly in the fossil record as you move up the geological column. And Darwin was aware of this in 1859 and actually wrote about it in his book. In my new book, Darwin's Doubt, I opened the book by saying that when Darwin finished his masterpiece, The Origin of Species, he thought he had explained every clue but one. And the one clue that he knew he hadn't explained was the evidence documenting the Cambrian explosion. And this was puzzling to him because he envisioned that the mechanism of natural selection acting on random variations would have to act very slowly, because the variations would need necessarily to be small and incremental so as not to produce major deformations in organisms in the next generation. And so, for him, the evolutionary process must take a great deal of time, and it would necessarily gradually change one type of organism into another. And yet, we don't see in the Precambrian rocks the evidence of those gradual transitions, those ancestral precursors or transitional intermediates that he expected to find. Instead, we see this abrupt appearance, quite to the contrary of his expectation. And so, in The Origin, he actually said that the Cambrian explosion was a valid objection to the views here entertained, as he put it.
Did he ever, after finishing Origin of Species, did he ever at least proffer an explanation for it?
Well, he proffered an explanation for the absence of evidence. He said it might be the case that what we're looking at is an incomplete preservation in the fossil record of all the forms that were actually there. And he said if we think of life as kind of like the fossil record is like a great story. We only have a chapter here and there, a couple of pages from another chapter. And he said, if we think of the fossil record in that way, it diminishes the problem of the Cambrian explosion. And of course, with that, he was expecting that in future generations of fossil discovery and fossil finds, that the ancestral precursors would turn up. But in fact, they haven't. There are 23 major animal phyla that are present in the Cambrian. 20 of them have no discernible ancestors in the Precambrian sedimentary record. The three that do have representatives in the Precambrian actually originate very suddenly in the late Precambrian and just begin a little bit earlier. And so there's really no evidence of these gradual transformations taking place, just a very a pervasive pattern of abrupt or sudden appearance.
So whether it appears in the late Precambrian or the Cambrian, it's still an abrupt appearance.
Right. We have, for example, sponges in the Cambrian, but the sponges just go back a little deeper into the late Precambrian and appear abruptly there. So the problem really isn't solved by pointing out that there are a few of the animal phyla in the late Precambrian. So it's a big problem, and it's grown more intense. The problem has been exacerbated by further fossil discovery. Darwin knew of just a few major Cambrian groups in his time, and now we know of these 23 odd phyla, more than 100 classes of organisms. The higher taxonomic groups appear very abruptly, and there are more of them than we thought, and they appear more suddenly than we realized. So in every sense, the Cambrian explosion has become more explosive since Darwin's time.
You used the term neo-Darwin before, for those of us who are not versed in the differences.
Yeah, a little inside baseball there, but Darwin didn't really have he didn't have a very good theory of genetics and how it worked. He didn't know about Mendel and he didn't know about mutations. So he talked about natural selection acting on random variations. Modern neo-Darwinism, the modern version of his theory, the standard textbook theory, discusses natural selection acting on random genetic variations in the information that's stored in the DNA molecule.
So is the sudden appearance the only kind of mystery that the Cambrian explosion presents the thoroughgoing Darwinist?
Actually not. It is a big mystery. In the first third of the book, I describe the mystery and show how it has become more acute as a result of future fossil discoveries and the failure of studies in genetics to kind of compensate for the missing fossils. But in the second part of the book, I look at what I regard as a more profound mystery, which is the mystery of essentially how you build an animal or how the evolutionary process could build an animal in the time allowed or indeed in the entire history of life on Earth. The time scale really, in the end, doesn't matter. The problem is that the mechanism of natural selection acting on random mutations lacks the creative power that has long been attributed to it. If you think about this problem has become also more acute, in particular because of discoveries in genetics and molecular biology about the importance of information, and I'm talking about digital code stored in the DNA molecule and other forms of biological information stored elsewhere beyond the DNA. I used to ask my students a question to get this idea across. If you want to build a new animal, if you want to give your computer a new function, what do you have to give it? And they would immediately say, well, you got to give it code or a software program or information or instructions. All those are correct answers. The same thing turns out to be true in life. If you want to build a new animal, if you want the evolutionary process to build a new animal, you've got to think of how it could generate information. And yet what we know about the Darwinian mechanism is that it relies heavily on random changes in the genetic text to generate that information. Now ask yourself a question. If you've got a section of software code, and we know that DNA is very much like a software code, and you start changing the zeros and ones at random, are you more likely to degrade that information or build a new software program or operating system? Obviously, you're much more likely to degrade the information that's there, and it turns out that the probabilities associated with the attempt to generate new information by the mutation selection mechanism are prohibitively small. Even generating a new gene or protein in the known history of life on Earth is a vastly improbable proposition. It's not, and so the mechanism is not really a plausible means of generating information. And that's one of four or five key problems with the mechanism and why it's not really a plausible way of building these animals that I address in the book.
So the Cambrian explosion is not just an explosion of life, but it's essentially, at the genetic level, an explosion of information.
Absolutely. I mean, you're right on point there. Because it's precisely what we now know. We can, in a sense, reverse engineer an animal and say, okay, what would be required to build one by the evolutionary process? Well, we know we have to have lots and lots of new genetic information to build the new proteins that service the new cell types that are part of the new organs and structures that arise with these animals. So we've got to have all that information. Turns out there's another type of information as well. It's now called epigenetic information, and biologists are talking about it pervasively, because we've learned that the DNA provides the instructions for building the proteins, but it doesn't tell the proteins how to arrange themselves into cellular structures or cells, how to arrange cell types into tissues or tissues into organs or organs and tissues into larger body plans. And yet what arises in the Cambrian period are whole new animal body plans, unique ways of arranging organs, tissues, and body parts to build these new animals. Well, if DNA only builds the low-level parts, the proteins, but other forms of information are necessary to build the whole animal form, then that means that you could mutate DNA, as the neo-Darwinists envision, indefinitely, and in the very best of cases, even if you didn't have to worry about the probabilities of building new genes, you would still only, in the best of cases, build a new protein. And yet, to build an animal, you need to organize proteins and all those and other structures into all those higher level forms and structures, and so mutating DNA alone will not build you an animal, and yet that's precisely what the neo-Darwinian theory says. And for that reason, there are many leading evolutionary biologists today who have rejected neo-Darwinism and are looking at new mechanisms of evolution and proposing them, because they realize that the standard mechanism simply lacks the creative power attributed to it. One group of scientists who are interested in this problem of epigenetic information say that neo-Darwinism lacks a theory of the generative. It explains the survival, but not the arrival of the fittest, as another scientist put it. So it's a really interesting time in the debate. It's not just advocates of intelligent design who see the inadequacies of the standard theory. It's evolutionary biologists themselves, and that's made for quite a creative discussion and ferment.
All right, I want to come back to something on the other side of this break that Dr. Meyer mentioned a minute ago. He said, maybe you caught it, he said, the time scale is irrelevant. Now, what does that mean? Does it mean that you can give the neo-Darwinist as much time as they ask for, and the mechanism that they say is going to eventually, given enough time, produce life and produce more complex and more varied and more different life and more information in the genetic code and the other information that is inherent in that life? If you give them as much time as they ask for, will their mechanism work? We'll answer that question on the other side of the break. We're talking about Charles Darwin, Darwinism, and the Cambrian Explosion. Dr. Stephen Meyer is our guest.
I'm not a Christian, but I listen to your show because actually you do have some interesting topics.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues Etc. comment line.
You believe that there's not one error in the Bible. That's intellectually infantile. You also believe that Jesus is coming again. You promote extremely sexually repressive views.
The Issues Etc. comment line, available 24/7, 618-223-8382.
Have fun waiting for Jesus to return. Got news for you. He ain't coming back.
You can listen to Issues Etc. live and on demand with the new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. You can get these apps at our website, issuesetc.org. Give us a call, send us an email, or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Issues Etc. in the palm of your hand. The new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. Download today at issuesetc.org.
There's an app for that.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The Church's music from the 2nd century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The 6th century. The 12th century.
Oh, come, O come, Emmanuel.
16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's Thursday afternoon, July the 18th. We're talking about Charles Darwin and the Cambrian Explosion. Dr. Stephen Meyer is our guest. I want to come back to something that you said earlier in our conversation. Dr. Meyer, you said that the time scale really is irrelevant. Are you saying that you can give the neo-Darwinists as much time as they ask for, and the mechanism that they allege that will work in their theory still won't do what they claim it will do?
I mean, I suppose if you got to infinite time or something close to it, there's some interesting. One of the chapters in the book looks at the neo-Darwinian mechanism from the standpoint of what I call the neo-Darwinian math. There is a subdiscipline of neo-Darwinism known as population genetics, and there are equations within population genetics that make it a mathematical discipline. And what these equations purport to do, is that they allow scientists to calculate how much evolutionary change can take place in a given amount of time if you know some factors like the mutation rate or the generation time for a particular population of organisms or the size of the population. And conversely, you can also calculate how long you would have to wait for a given change to take place. These are called waiting times. Well, as scientists have begun to apply these, biologists have begun to apply these equations to the problem of coordinated adaptive mutations, changes that would be necessary to build certain structures that require two or more mutations occurring in a coordinated fashion. What they've discovered mathematically is that the more such mutations are necessary, as with each additional mutation necessary to build a complex feature like that, the waiting times rise exponentially. And so for even three coordinated mutations, the expected waiting times exceed the known time of life on Earth, 500 billion or three, actually well beyond the 3.5 billion year window in which we think life has been on Earth. And so the issue of time scale, billions of years are not enough to generate even very modest changes, provided the kind of modest changes that are involved with two or three mutations working in coordination. And when you look at an event like the Cambrian explosion, many more coordinated mutations than three would be necessary to build those animals. So it's the waiting time issue is another thing I look at in the book, and it's another critique of the creative power of the neo-Darwinian mechanism. The take-home there is that the neo-Darwinian math shows that the neo-Darwinian mechanism is lacking the creative power that's been attributed to it.
So to kind of pause at this point, it sounds like one of the conclusions we might draw here is that Darwin himself could be excused for not realizing essentially the problem he was creating for those who would pick up his theory. Apart from the Cambrian explosion, he could be excused for that, but neo-Darwinists really have far less excuse than their theoretical ancestor.
I think that's an interesting way of putting the debate in context, because, of course, Darwin didn't know what future fossil discoveries would show, and they have shown that the ancestral precursors in the Cambrian haven't turned up, and that likely the Cambrian explosion is a real event, not an artifact of incomplete sampling. He didn't know about Mendelian genetics. He didn't know about mutations. And he certainly didn't know about the discoveries of Watson and Crick and the molecular biological revolution, which have documented the importance, the primacy of information to the origin and maintenance of new forms of life. He didn't know about epigenetic information. And all of these new discoveries have made the Darwinian view of things, in particular the modern neo-Darwinian theory of evolution, increasingly implausible and untenable. And in evidence of that, I show in the book that it's not just advocates of intelligent design who are saying this, or even biologists generally. It's actually evolutionary biologists, people who work in this specific field, who are now calling for a new theory of evolution, or who are furiously busy working to devise such new theories. And so one of the things I do in the book is I describe six new post-neo-Darwinian theories, and then I also critique them. I acknowledge that each of these theories has some advantages over the standard textbook theory that we all learn of neo-Darwinism, but I also show that each of these theories, in turn, fail to account for the origin of the information that's necessary to build new forms of animal life. And so at the fundamental level, they too are inadequate. And it's into that mix that I then propose as a positive alternative the theory of intelligent design.
So why aren't we hearing about this? Is there a disparity between the public face of the neo-Darwinist and what they're saying amongst themselves?
Well, that's actually one of the themes of the book, is that there is a huge disparity between the public presentation of the status of evolutionary theory as something that is indubitable. Richard Dawkins says that if you find someone who doubts Darwinian evolution, they're either stupid, wicked. No, he says they're either stupid, ignorant, or insane. And then he says parenthetically, or perhaps wicked, but he prefers not to think about that. And you have all the major science organizations, AAAS and National Academy of Sciences, having issued statements saying there is no controversy about evolutionary theory. The New York Times science writer Cornelia Dean has picked up those statements and repeated them many times. So you have this group I call Darwin's public defenders who are making these very dogmatic statements. But then you get into the technical peer-reviewed literature in biology, and you find that it's a very different story, and that even leading evolutionary theorists are now attempting to formulate new theories because they recognize that the neo-Darwinian mechanism does not have a theory of the generative. It does not account for the origin of fundamentally new organs and forms of life, organs and body plans. It's a big problem. And it doesn't account for the origin of the new information, either epigenetic or genetic, that's necessary to build these animals.
So let's get into some of the detail there. First of all, what is the boilerplate response of neo-Darwinists to the Cambrian explosion? How do they explain it in either their popular literature or when they're speaking publicly on the subject?
Well, there was an interesting bevy of internet reviews that came up for the book. The book released on June 18th, and by 3 o'clock in the morning, there were already negative reviews of the book on the Amazon.com website. The next day, there was one on the 19th. It was about a 10,000-word review written by a grad student at Berkeley, and he claimed that the Cambrian explosion took much longer than I had claimed, that it took 30 million years. In fact, the standard date in paleontology is about 10 million years, and what I show in the book is that the most explosive pulse of morphological innovation, that means the period of time in which you get the biggest number of new types of animals coming on the scene, is actually now been dated to within 5 million years. About 14 to 16 of the major phyla arise in that very narrow window. And so any theory of macroevolution has to account for the origin of that amount of new form and structure in that brief window of time. And again, I say it's a brief window of time. It's certainly a brief window geologically. It's a very small percentage of the total period of life's history as geologists measure it. But it's also, again, a brief period of time biologically because of the amount of time that the neo-Darwinian mechanism needs to have at its disposal in order to generate any fundamentally new forms of life, let alone even a new gene or protein. And that's one of the things I show in the book, as we've already discussed, is that even very modest changes involving just a few coordinated mutations end up requiring waiting times that exceed the duration of life on Earth, let alone a 5 or 10 million year window of the Cambrian explosion.
And you mentioned earlier that there were
so give them 30 million years. It doesn't change the issue, even if that is an incorrect date for the period of the Cambrian.
So you mentioned some. Can we call them post-Darwinian?
Yeah, theories? Post-Darwinian or post-neo-Darwinian theories, right?
Give us an example of a couple.
Well, one would be the punctuated equilibrium idea of Stephen Jay Gould and Niles Eldridge, which was very popular in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. That's kind of run its course. It was an attempt to describe the fossil record more accurately, and because the paleontologists, Gould and Eldridge in particular, recognized that the pattern in the fossil record was one of more pervasive discontinuity, punctuations, more events of sudden appearance, followed by long periods of stasis, of a lack of evolutionary change. and so they tried to modify evolutionary theory to account for that, and they did a better job of describing the fossil record, but they were really unable to come up with any kind of persuasive mechanism that, or credible mechanism that could account for the major the sudden appearance of the major forms of animal life. And so in the end, they even acknowledged that their mechanism that they proposed relied tacitly on natural selection and random mutations, which really took them right back to where they started with the mystery of how could you build that much animal form that quickly when the mechanism requires so much time. But there are other theories, like the theory of self-organization, one called neo-Lamarckian epigenetic inheritance, the neutral theory of evolution, and several others. And I examine all of these, and I think it's one of the things that will really bring readers up to date on the state of evolutionary biology and also make people who are skeptical about the mainstream naturalistic evolutionary theories, I think they'll find some encouragement in this, because even when you do a comprehensive survey of the other ideas out there, they're really, as I said, there's some advantages in these new theories, but none of them provide mechanisms that account for the origin of the information that's necessary to build a new form of animal life. And that's the fundamental question. So it has been left either unaddressed, or very oftentimes what these new theories do is they subtly assume the existence of information rather than explain its origin.
We'll be right back. We're talking about Charles Darwin and the Cambrian explosion. Stay tuned. Did you know that Logia, a journal of Lutheran theology, sells CDs and audio downloads of teachings by some of the top Lutheran theologians in the country? Check out Logia's 99-cent download of the month at shop.logia.org. Shop.logia.org. You'll also find books published by Luther Academy and, of course, the quarterly Logia Journal at shop.logia.org. Continuing education for the confessional Lutheran, shop.logia.org.
Steadfast Lutherans, people who believe that traditional Lutheran preaching, liturgy, and hymnody continue to deliver Christ crucified for sinners today. The Reformation attempted to return the Church's focus on what we do for God back to a focus on what God does for us, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures. Some things never change. The Gospel is still under attack from inside and outside the Church. To see how Lutheran doctrine and practice preserve the Gospel, visit steadfastlutherans.org.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Holy Trinity Lutheran, Garfield, New Jersey. Grace Lutheran, Naples, Florida. St. John's Lutheran, Chicago, Illinois. St. Paul Lutheran, Unionville, Michigan. Mount Calvary Lutheran, Beverly Hills, California. Epiphany Lutheran, Door, Michigan. The Good Shepherd Lutheran, Inglewood, California. St. John's Lutheran, Sayville, New York. Apostles Lutheran, Melrose Park, Illinois. Christ Our Savior Lutheran, Elizabeth, Colorado. Grace Lutheran, Strasburg, Illinois. And Bethel Lutheran, Thunder Bay, Ontario, Canada. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal, the Issues Etc. 300. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Stephen Meyer is our guest, director of the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute based in Seattle, and author of the book Darwin's Doubt. We're talking about Charles Darwin and the Cambrian Explosion. Before we talk about intelligent design, Dr. Meyer, dispel a very common myth that's aggressively pushed by much of the scientific community, at least popularly, that intelligent design is nothing more than creationism masquerading as scientific theory.
Right, right. When we get called creationists in cheap tuxedos and things like that, and my wife bitterly resents that. I do have a tuxedo, and it wasn't cheap. So, but you know, it is the attempt to conflate two things that are really different. Intelligent design and creationism are different in two really important respects. The basis of creationism is usually a particular interpretation of the first book of Genesis. And then a deduction from that as to what the natural world ought to look like, what the evidence ought to look like. And secondly, creationism is addressing a question, namely the question of the age of the earth, that the theory of intelligent design doesn't address. The most popular version of creationism is young earth creationism, and it asserts that the earth is very young and that the days mentioned in the Genesis account correspond to literal 24-hour periods, and therefore the evidence from the geology ought to show that the Earth is very, very, very young, you know, maybe 10,000 years or something. The theory of intelligent design is not a theory about the age of the Earth. It's not trying to settle the question of whether the Earth is young or old. It's a question about whether it's addressing a different question, and that is the question of whether there's evidence of just apparent design in the biological realm, as the neo-Darwinists say, or whether there's evidence of real design, design that derives from an actual designing intelligence, from a purposive intelligent agent. And the neo-Darwinists have long insisted, and Darwin himself insisted, that there is no design, no actual design in living organisms. All biologists acknowledge the appearance of design. Richard Dawkins says that biology is, in fact, the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. But he emphasizes the key word of appearance. For neo-Darwinists, the appearance of design is an illusion, and it's an illusion because there is, in their view, an unguided, undirected, purposeless process, namely natural selection acting on random mutations that can produce the appearance of design, that can mimic the powers of a designing intelligence without being guided or directed in any way. And that's the meaning of evolution that the theory of intelligent design was specifically formulated to challenge. Evolution might just mean change over time, for example. We're not disputing that things have changed over time or that life is different now than it was a long time ago. So we're not disputing that meaning of evolution. We're disputing the idea that a purposeless process, in particular natural selection and random mutations, produced all the forms of life we see today, and particularly that it produced the appearance of design that the biologists recognize in living organisms. We think there are many appearances of design, in particular the digital code, the circuitry that we find in organisms, things like that, that are giving evidence of an actual designing intelligence in the history of life. So that also makes us different than creationism, which is addressing more the question of the age of the earth and how to interpret the Genesis text. Also, the theory of intelligent design is an inference from biological evidence. It's not an interpretation or a deduction from scriptural authority.
So intelligent design says, look, we are going to look at exactly the same data that the neo-Darwinist looks at, and we are going to look at it and say, does it not only appear to have been designed, is it demonstrable that the evidence is... it has been designed.
Right. And that's where I get in the book, where I go in the book beyond a mere critique of neo-Darwinism to making an actual positive scientific argument for intelligent design. I was first exposed to the idea of intelligent design back in the mid-80s. A scientist named Charles Thaxton had written an important book about the origin of the first life, and then in the epilogue to the book, after which he had critiqued these what they're called chemical evolutionary theories of the origin of the first life, he suggested that there may be a need to invoke an intelligent cause to explain some of the phenomena we're seeing, even in the very simplest cells, in particular the information encoded in DNA. He argued that intuitively, the information is a kind of mind product. It's something that comes from an intelligent cause or source, and he speculated that perhaps an intelligent cause therefore could be necessary to explain what we see in the origin of life. I was fortunate enough to meet Dr. Thaxton, and he and I got to know each other when I was a young scientist, then working in the oil industry. And a year later, I was off to grad school to Cambridge, and I began to think about the things that he and I had discussed, and I began to wonder if it was possible to formulate this idea that he had as a rigorous scientific hypothesis. In other words, the intuition that information seems to point to mind or intelligence, could that be made into a rigorous scientific theory? And ironically, I came to the conclusion that it could be because of what I was studying in Charles Darwin. Darwin pioneered a method of scientific reasoning that's more historical or forensic. He knew you couldn't get trilobites, for example, to arise all over again in the laboratory under controlled laboratory conditions. So he realized that if you were trying to explain an event in the remote past, you had to reason from the clues that were left behind back to the causes of the event you were trying to explain. And that method of reasoning is called the method of inference to the best explanation. And he had a principle of reasoning that helped define what was best, and that was that the best explanation is the one that invokes a cause which is known to produce the effect in question. And when I came across that principle, I realized it applied directly to this issue of the origin of information, because what we know from our experience, our uniform and repeated experience in the present, is that information always arises from an intelligent source. And so when you look at an event like the Cambrian explosion, which is an explosion, as you said, of information, not just form and structure, we realize, I argue, that we're looking at evidence, we have decisive evidence of prior purposive intelligence, precisely because what we know in the present about what cause is capable of generating information, and that is intelligence, or what we call intelligent design.
What does intelligent design proposed by way of explanation for the Cambrian explosion? We've got about 2 minutes here.
Yeah, well, it's basically proposing a cause which we know from our experience is sufficient. Darwin was basing his methods of reasoning and his method of science on a method that had been developed by one of his scientific mentors, Charles Lyell. And Lyell said when we're trying to explain an event in the remote past, we should be looking for causes now in operation. In other words, This was behind his dictum, the present is the key to the past. Our present knowledge of cause and effect is what illuminates what happened in the past. So if we're trying to explain the origin of the Cambrian information explosion, we have to ask ourselves what kind of cause explains explosions of information in the present. So as we look at the explosion of computer code or hieroglyphic inscriptions or the information present in a book or a radio signal, and we trace it back to its source, we always find an intelligence, a mind, not a material process behind that. And so what intelligent design is proposing as the ultimate causal explanation for the Cambrian explosion is actually the activity of a designing intelligence. One information scientist put it this way. He said that the creation of information is habitually associated with conscious activity. That's what we know from our observation in the present of the cause and effect structure of the world, of the causes now in operation, as Lyell and Darwin would have put it. And so we're proposing that there's an intelligent infusion of information into the biosphere, and that accounts for both the origin of the information and the origin of the animals that are built from that information in the Cambrian period.
With only a minute here, Dr. Meyer, you said at the very beginning of our conversation that the fossil record has not proven to be Darwin's best friend, even if you lay aside the Cambrian explosion, and you say, okay, let's just set that aside and table that discussion. Does the fossil record any better snuggle up to Darwinism?
Well, as I mentioned, it's gotten worse. The pervasive pattern of the fossil record is one of a discontinuous or geologically sudden appearance of the major groups of animals. And Darwin hoped that those discontinuities, those gaps, would be filled in by future fossil studies. But in fact, the gaps have become more pronounced as more Cambrian animals have been found, each of which has in turn lacked any discernible ancestral precursor in the lower Precambrian strata. And so the pattern has become more pronounced, the mysteries become more acute, and as I said, it's not the only mystery. The deeper mystery is how you build these fascinating creatures in the first place, and that's where I think intelligent design has a lot to offer.
Dr. Stephen Meyer is director of the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute based in Seattle. He's author of numerous books, including his latest, Darwin's Doubt, The Explosive Origin of Animal Life, and The Case for Intelligent Design. You'll find a link to the website for Darwin's Doubt under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Dr. Meyer, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on and for a terrific interview and conversation.
When we come back in Hour 2 of Issues, Etc., Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse is going to join us. There's news from Great Britain about same-sex marriage. The Queen apparently approves. It's gotten her nod. That sets up a contrast that we'll talk about with Jennifer between Britain and France on same-sex marriage. Also, in the second hour of the program, we'll talk about Ezekiel, who is remembered on Sunday this week, July the 21st. Ezekiel and the Book of Revelation, Dr. Charles Geeshan will be our guest. That's Hour 2 of Issues, Etc. One of the biggest questions we always have and have ever since we had the Issues, Etc. Making the Case conference from conference goers and those who did not attend was, when are you going to make the audio of the conference available? Well, we're ready to do that. 8 hours of audio on one audio DVD available to those who did not attend the conference for a donation of $300. And you will get that conference audio DVD before Labor Day, a donation of $300. It's very easy to do, and you can find out more by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Look for the logo of the Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference audio DVD right there. Click on that, and you'll have a way to donate and find out more about how you can get the conference audio DVD from the Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference. Hour 2 of Issues, Etc. straight ahead on this Thursday afternoon, July the 18th. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues, Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Rick Warren is the center of a spiderweb network that crosses every denomination in the world. And he has as much power, if not more, in the LCMS than Matthew Harrison.
Chris Roseborough speaking at this year's Issues, Etc. Making the Case conference.
Think of Rick Warren as a guy who has a pan district within the LCMS. There are pastors within the LCMS who would sooner call up Rick Warren or some of the guys in his coaching network asking for help than they would call their own district president or, God forbid, Matt Harrison. In other words, Rick Warren is probably one of the most powerful men in our synod.
You can listen to Chris's entire presentation and all of the presentations from the Issues, Etc. Making the Case conference on our new audio DVD for a donation of $300 to Issues, Etc. before Labor Day. We'll send you this audio DVD. For more information, look for the DVD logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org.